You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In a recent op-ed piece, New York Times reporter Elizabeth Rosenthal wrote, as of January 1st, the Affordable Care Act promises for the first time to deliver the possibility of meaningful health insurance to every American. But where does that leave the United States in terms of affordable care? That's been one of the central questions she's been trying to get to the bottom of in an ongoing healthcare series called Paying Till It Hurts, and the answers haven't always been pretty. Elizabeth Rosenthal joins us now, and I'm pleased to welcome her back to our show. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Today is the deadline to enroll in coverage under the Affordable Care Act for, I think it's 35 states or so. It had been pushed back from December 15th. Why has it been so difficult to get this program off the ground? Is it simply because the computer system wasn't working well?
Well, I mean, certainly a bad computer system and a bad program didn't help. But, you know, basically this is a very big transformation in American healthcare. And as someone I quoted in the story said, you know, the Affordable Care Act is a complicated patch on a very complicated system. So to ask individuals to suddenly shop for health insurance is a really, really complicated thing to program.
When you say patch, you mean it's a Band-Aid on a festering sore?
Yeah, I hate to use that with, medical analogies here. But yes, you know, it's trying to use the system we have to give everyone coverage and somewhat to control costs. And that's, you know, a lot of people don't know if that can be done, honestly.
And what is your sense? You think it will have an impact on medical costs, a positive impact?
It depends who you are. there are early studies suggesting that it's having some control on the rise in prices. But we're not talking about actually bringing them down. We're just talking about them rising not as fast. So, yes, there are some elements. But the whole reason I did that piece on the weekend, which, you know, officially, since I'm a reporter, is a news analysis, not an op-ed, is I think everyone generally agrees now that it's not enough if we really care about costs.
People who enroll in the program today will have until December 31st to get their first premium in. Given that Christmas falls right in the middle of these two deadlines, I'm suspecting that not everyone will be able to make the payment on time.
Yeah, you know, this is a very big change, and we'll see how much forgiveness there is. But, you know, some people are going to find that this delivers much better insurance, and some people are going to, for a lower cost, and some people are going to find that their costs go up. And there's a lot of learning to do about how this system works.
In that opinion piece, thank you for correcting me, you wrote, having spent the last year reporting for a series of articles on the high cost of American medicine, I've heard it all. What have been some of the biggest horror stories?
Oh, I mean, they really are too numerous to count. I mean, one I mentioned in the lead of that story, a guy who went in for what he called a little rattlesnake bite, loved the care. You know, people say, oh, I got good care. But then he got the bill within a week for over $100,000, you know, for a very short visit. So I do want to stress, I'm not hearing from the people who have rare cancers who have $2 million bills. I'm hearing from the people who have relatively ordinary things and are losing their homes, are, getting bills of $10,000, $20,000 that they just can't afford.
Including huge bills for things like having stitches put into your hand or your head.
Yeah, I mean,
stitches are not exactly a new development in medicine.
I wanted to say it was one of the oldest medical interventions, but we thought people might complain, well, there are other things. But yes, it's a relatively simple procedure. It's often not done by a physician. It's done by a physician's assistant. It takes a few minutes. There's not a lot of expertise. More and more, they're just putting in glue. So why does it cost $3,000? And people want to know that. We pick stitches because we got a lot of letters from people saying, my kid had this little cut, and I suddenly faced a bill of $3,000-$4,000.
And what did the hospital say is the reason that they're charging so much for that?
They'll say there's a lot of cost shifting. There are a lot of things they don't get paid for. But I think more and more when you look at hospital bills, there doesn't seem to be very much they don't get paid for. They figure out how to bill for everything. And when you look at some of these stitches bills, you know, they're being charged a few hundred dollars for a finger splint. Or if it's a trauma case, they're being charged a $10,000 trauma activation fee. What's that for? You know, because it's trauma.
So you're saying that their argument is because we do some things which we don't get paid for, we're shifting the cost over to you when we give you some stitches because you can afford to pay it?
Yes, and I think
although they're not necessarily sure that you can afford to pay it.
Right, and the thing is, you know, if you're insured, your insurer will say that's ridiculous and cut it down maybe to $1,500. But more and more people are facing, policies where the first $5,000-$10,000 they're paying. So suddenly the people in my story, even though most of them were insured, they were left with out-of-pocket costs in the thousands for this, you know, really, really simple procedure.
Healthcare costs in the United States are often twice that of other developed countries. Did anyone at any level in the healthcare system have much of an incentive to cut prices?
In our healthcare system, not at all. And especially on emergency room care, you don't ask up front, hey, what's it going to cost for my stitches? You just bring your kid into the ER.
And then if an ambulance is involved, that becomes another major expense. And it wasn't all that long ago that ambulances were provided free of cost. What happened?
Yeah, we actually did a day two story on this. People look for how they can monetize whatever they do in medical care. I mean, and when you think about it, a lot of ambulances are run by the fire department. They don't charge you if there's a fire in your house, but if it's for an ambulance service, you are charged. And P.S., most people don't call the ambulance themselves. An onlooker will say, ooh, you know, she looks sick. Better call an ambulance. And then you're stuck with the bill.
Not only that, you have no idea whether the ambulance that arrives is one that charges a lot or one that charges less.
Or one that's in your insurance network or one that's out of your insurance network. I mean, it's really, it puts, you know, if you want to talk about being a good consumer of healthcare, emergency medical care is the thing you really can't be a consumer of.
So we don't get an upfront estimate on so many things like the ambulance, but also when you go into the emergency room, they don't say, well, we're going to have to put five stitches in. This is going to cost you $3,000. What's the alternative?
Right.
Bleed to death?
That's the problem, especially with emergency care. It's not like you have a choice there. You can't go down the street when the ambulance is there. Now, what the companies and some of the hospitals will say in there, they'll say, oh, well, you didn't have to get in the ambulance. You could refuse. But guess what? If you refuse, they put on their records refused medical attention. And people are nervous about doing that. And when an ambulance paramedic says you should be on a backboard, are you going to say, too expensive? No, you're going to say, oh, well, I guess I should.
In fact, they love to put that refused medical attention on anything. If you go into an emergency room and then they tell you that they think you should have something that you think is rather ridiculous, then they have you sign a waiver saying, I refuse medical attention. It happened to me a couple of times. I'm still here.
Yeah. Now, and they will say, and with some justification, that there are all these legal ramifications. They might get sued if that isn't done. But I think more and more, not only do you get this refused medical attention, but you get labeled as a difficult patient. I've had the experience where I hurt my ankle. They wanted a big X-ray series, and I said no. And the question was, well, why do you care? Your insurance will cover it. And I think what I want people to do is care, whether their insurance covers it or not. But it does put you in a very tenuous position because you will be seen as the patient who's difficult and who's refusing medical attention.
My guest is Elizabeth Rosenthal, who has been writing a series of healthcare articles called Paying Till It Hurts in the New York Times. Aren't certain things that Americans could do to lower their own healthcare prices illegal, like reimporting American drugs that are made in this country and then sold more cheaply abroad?
Yeah, a lot of what we could do is illegal. A lot of the information we could use to shop around for hospital care isn't available to us. I think that's a big problem, one that should be relatively solvable. I mean, for this last article, I looked at the charge master, the price list of a hospital in California, where you, in theory, if you knew medical coding, could figure out what procedures would be billed at. But most states do not require hospitals to even list those charge master prices. And that's a question I think we all have to ask. When I spoke to an orthopedic surgeon in France, he said he's required before surgery to have a contract with the patient that states a price. So why aren't our doctors and our hospitals giving us prices we can use to be consumers should we choose that?
Is that something that would require legislation?
California did it for hospitals. I think you could require hospitals to post price lists. But more than that, patients, you know, should take some of the responsibility, I think, and start asking and start demanding. I would go to a hospital that told me more about its price structure.
Well, some of the horror stories you write about do involve California hospitals, and this is despite the legislation. You write about Sutter Health in California, one of the hospitals. Their hospitals is California Pacific Medical Center, and at that particular hospital, an IV fluid bag costs $137, but if you go to buy one in this on the market, it's $1. Are they making $136 profit?
Well, they have gotten a lot of criticism from the state for high charges. So, yes, they're making a big profit. And I would say California has done the first step of making these charges public in some place, in some form. But it's not a user-friendly form. The next step has to be, if we're going that, you know, consumer-oriented fee-for-service route, is kind of like a menu where there are prices on it, not like one where, you know, you don't know what anything's going to cost.
Well, at California Pacific, a knee arthroscopy, is it called, which should cost around $2,000, costs over $14,000. And the hospital also charges $731 for each hour a pregnant woman is in labor, on top of the $5,500 cost of normal delivery. How can a hospital justify that? And what about that poor woman who is already in pain for a few hours and keeps on seeing the ticking, $731 each hour?
Right. Well, you're kind of glad that we don't have a system where you have the meter running like that, because everyone would want to, you know, I don't know, you would want to be out of there as fast as you can. But the point I want to make about California Pacific Medical Center is it's particularly good at doing what it does as a business plan. Not, you know,
but it's a nonprofit hospital.
Right. But
isn't
every
it?
Hospital is doing this. Every hospital is doing this, some more than others. What California Pacific, well, the reason I focused on them is, A, their charges are higher than most, but and they have better market penetration than most, so they can have higher charges, and California requires them to file these documents. But I guarantee you there are hospitals in Boston, in New York, in Miami doing the exact same thing.
But isn't this hospital a nonprofit? Which I gather is good for them because it gives them a special tax status.
Yes.
But as you point out, California Pacific Medical Center's main campuses spent 1.27% of, that's 1.25% of their more than $1.1 billion in net patient revenues in 2011 on free care for indigent or uninsured patients. That's lower than the state average of 2.7%, which also strikes me
which
as rather
is not
low.
Very high.
So who's getting the money? Is it the healthcare executives at California Pacific? Its owner, Sutter Health?
Yes. You'll find most hospitals in the U.S. are not for profit. That doesn't mean they don't make profits. It just means they don't have shareholders. So what they do is they can use that money for anything. As you said, they often pay their executives very well. You know, the Sutter CEO, I think, is making about $5 million a year, while doctors are making in the $500,000 range, you know, the highly paid surgeons, maybe. But So they can use it to build a new hospital, which they're doing. They can build it to buy more stuff. They can build it for us. You know, they can build Starbucks in the lobby. But the question is that what we should be paying for in patient care? And does that sound like a nonprofit? I mean, all of these hospitals, three quarters of them in the U.S. are not for profit, and they are getting big tax breaks for that. So if they say, you know, we have to charge $3,000 for stitches because we have all this other stuff we do for free. Well, they're getting a lot back in tax exemptions. So the accounting is very, very muddled.
And then we assume that some of this pays for emergency room care. I'm going to take a little break. We'll find out why many hospitals now see emergency rooms as profit centers. My guest is Elizabeth Rosenthal of the New York Times. Her series is called Paying Till It Hurts, and I assume it's you've told me in the past your plan was to do it over 1 year. It looks like it's going to go a lot longer than that.
So far, it's a growth topic.
It's a growth industry for
it's
you,
a growth
Elizabeth.
Industry, right.
We'll be back with more right after this. We're back with Elizabeth Rosenthal of the New York Times. She's been writing a series on healthcare in America called Paying Till It Hurts, and we thought that would be a good time to talk to her today because today is the deadline for entering Obamacare. And I want to come back to Obamacare in a moment, but since we've been talking about hospitals, you note that in many hospitals, emergency rooms are profit centers, and I always thought that ERs were money pits. What's happened?
Right. I was surprised. I used to work at an ER when I was a doctor, and we were always losing money. But basically, the hospitals have figured out how to monetize them. And what you can do is you can, first of all, you charge $3,000 for some stitches. You charge a facility fee. Now what you find is you go into the ER. The doctor is not included. He's billing separately. Like I mentioned, there's a trauma activation fee. And you can also do a lot of clever things about where you place your ER and what kinds of patients you take. If you don't take trauma patients, you're more likely to make money because they involve long, complicated hospital stays.
And you're right that the financial prospects are so appealing that doctors' groups in Texas are opening freestanding emergency rooms that are not connected to hospitals.
Right. And this is, again, you know, it's gaming the accounting system just like Wall Street does. And the question that this has been an issue in upstate New York, too, I hear. And the question is, can you have a freestanding ER? What does even that mean? What if you really need a hospital? They're not connected to it. Also, some of the freestanding ERs aren't open 24 hours. They close at 5. So what kind of emergency room is that?
Do other countries talk or think about patients as healthcare consumers?
Not the way we do. I mean, you know, this is considered a right like education generally in other countries. And many countries use fee-for-service models of some sort still, but they make sure that they're affordable. For example, in Belgium, patients are expected to pay 20% of fees, but if the fee is, you know, $1,000 rather than $50,000, that's manageable.
A listener called in to say that he took his son to the emergency room, which said that it took his insurance. But it turns out the doctor who treated his son didn't take that insurance, so he was charged out of pocket for the doctor's care. And what is, does that happen often?
That happens very often. ER physicians are now frequently privately, they're private groups who charge separately. So just like when you have your colonoscopy and you discover the anesthesiologist wasn't in network, so too the ER doctor cannot be in network.
I thought that they all were, anybody in the ER was an employee of the hospital.
That's what it used to be. Now they're almost always privately contracted groups.
I was thinking about California Pacific again, the hospital that charged so much, even though it's a nonprofit. Would other hospitals in that area, not owned by Sutter Pacific, have different prices? Is there competition?
There is some competition, but what you find in most major markets is that just a few medical groups dominate. So there are a few, two other health systems there, but they work together, basically. When Sutter charges $10,000 for something, the other groups go, well, hey, we can go to $9,000 and we'll still be a bargain. So it's inherently inflationary.
And, of course, when someone falls down a flight of stairs or is hit by a bus, you don't have the option to shop around.
Yeah, and you don't want to go to what you think of as a second-rate hospital either.
Now, would a hospital in San Francisco, which works on a certain level, price similarly to a hospital in New York or Chicago?
Well, since competition is pretty local, they tend to be in a band in different cities. And we found for simple ER procedures, Truven Health Analytics ran some data for us. The Pacific region was the highest in the country, considerably higher than, say, Boston, which you think of as a, you know, really high quality medical town. Not as high in ER pricing, though.
Well, is that partly because Massachusetts also has Romney Care, the predecessor to Obamacare?
That probably has something to do with it. But really, you also find that Pacific area is higher than the South or the Midwest. It's the highest in the country. So I think it has a lot more to do with the local market forces at play.
You write that Obamacare deals only indirectly with high prices.
Mm. Yeah,
I thought that was the whole point.
Well, I think that's a somewhat of a misconception because it's called the Affordable Care Act. What it really is the Affordable Insurance Act. You know, it gives, which is really important, it gives the opportunity of insurance to everyone. It doesn't do very much directly to control prices, and that's because mostly it wasn't allowed to. It had to work with the U.S. private health care market. So it sets up all these indirect forces to bring down prices. I call it a trickle-down theory of medical price control. And we all know how well trickle-down theories work.
A caller who is a physician, used to work in Canada, says that not all the profit goes to doctors. Most ER physicians are under contract and don't get paid more or less. Others, and often insurance companies, deny their claims.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think there's any one bad guy, and it's definitely wrong to focus on doctors exclusively because they are often the cogs in a big machine. But I think all of us are responsible, including the consumers who think, well, I'm not paying for it, so why should I care?
Now, you mentioned trickle down in describing Obamacare's cost containment strategies. Does it surprise you when people describe the Affordable Care Act as socialist or communist? Since it really depends on
companies? I find it very ironic when it's described as socialist because it really has to rely on the private system. It involves far less regulation and pricing than every other healthcare system in the world, socialist or fee-for-service.
And I seem to remember that it was originally proposed by the Heritage Foundation, which now opposes it, but they came up with this as an alternative to single-payer.
Yes, and I think, we rejected single payer. We rejected Medicare expansion. We don't want to all go to the VA for health care, which delivers probably the one model of cost-effective, decent care as a system in this country. It is very much relying on the private market, and this is what we get.
Has our reliance on the market and our political culture's resistance to direct government intervention put us at a disadvantage?
Well, yes, because it means that everyone is negotiating one-on-one. The hospitals are negotiating individually with insurers. Where you really save a lot of money in healthcare costs is if you have national negotiations where all the doctors negotiate with a unit with all the hospitals for a set reasonable price. But no one really has that kind of pricing power in the U.S. at the moment.
My guest is New York Times reporter Elizabeth Rosenthal. Her series, Paying Till It Hurts, has been appearing regularly in the newspaper, and we'll be seeing a new one soon.
Hopefully in the next couple of weeks.
This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You quote a former Obama advisor who said, if you put our health care system on an island and floated it out to the Atlantic, it would have the fifth largest GDP in the world. It's like saying you have to change the economy of France. Is that part of the problem here?
Well, that's a big part of the problem. When you talk about hospitals in cities downsizing or streamlining their care, they say, oh, wait a second, that's going to mean job loss, which it will. That's a big problem. Much of our, when you look at the growth sectors in our slowly recovering economy, healthcare is one of them. So you really have to move. I mean, the dilemma is for jobs and for the economy, maybe you have to move slowly, but to make these costs manageable for individuals, you have to do something pretty fast.
A caller wants to know, what's the solution to the high cost of emergency care? Is there any move to standardize costs from hospital to hospital?
Not that I've heard of. I mentioned in the piece this weekend a few possibilities of things that might help. For example, one is called capitated care, where your physician hospital group is given a yearly fee to take care of whatever you need. But very few places are doing that. It's really hard to get from the model we have now to that. And so for that, I don't think there's a good quick solution.
Are the biggest drivers of medical costs hospitalizations and end-of-life care?
Well, hospitalizations are a big chunk of our medical inflation. I think someone said 40%. So, yes, it's very hard to know how to get that down. I mean, there are a lot of innovations that are out there. Some companies are refusing to pay more than a certain amount for a procedure like a hip replacement. There's been a lot of success with that. But again, it's all demonstration projects and experiments, and we need really large-scale movement pretty soon.
Well, I once had to go to a hospital in Germany, in Berlin, They do not have a single-payer system in Germany, and they were actually afraid that I was going to skip town without paying my bill. My bill for fabulous I shared a room, but the food, which I could not keep down because I was not well, but the treatment was extraordinary, and the cost was, by American standards, laughably low.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Germany sets rates. It says what's an allowable rate for a given service. We don't do that. And the rates are a fraction of what they are in the United States. And German doctors feel like they're pretty well paid. So,
well, a listener wonders if the cost of medical school contributes to the high cost of medical care.
Yeah, there will be more on this in the next article. But, yes, it does somewhat. I mean, medical school is very expensive here. But doctors recoup that investment very quickly in their practice. So, you know, and people have resisted the idea of maybe we should pay for medical school in exchange for service from doctors. The Army does that already. But, you know, we don't like those kinds of solutions in the U.S.
Well, we've talked about rate setting, but don't Medicare and Medicaid programs set rates?
Yeah, Medicaid does set rates, and doctors and hospitals universally will tell you they are, you know, absurdly low compared to their costs. Medicare does set rates too, but on a fee-for-service basis on the outpatient side. So if you don't like your Medicare rate, you can charge for a lot of different things. You know, there's creative billing too. For inpatient care, Medicare does something very interesting, which I think we'll be seeing a lot more of, which is bundled care. So if you go in for to have your appendix out under Medicare, the hospital will get a flat rate, and they have to figure out how to give you the care you need within that rate setting. And some patients will cost them more, some patients will cost them less.
Well, has that been applied in the Affordable Care Act?
No, not
because people see this as a kind of extension of Medicare, but it isn't.
No, the private insurers tend to pay fee-for-service for all policies still. And we're using private insurers through the Affordable Care Act. We are not using Medicare.
And the hospitals will tell you, excuse me, what are you worried? You mentioned this earlier. What are you worried about? Your insurance company is going to pick up the bill.
Right. Now, first of all, increasingly, they won't be. And second of all, we really have to worry about our national budget and our as well as our private finances.
If you listen to the people in Congress, we have the best healthcare system in the world. And a lot of people believe that paying more means that they're receiving better care.
No study has ever shown that outcomes in the U.S. are better than anywhere in any other developed country. So I think that's a common myth. We're paying for more care, not necessarily better care. So I think and if you ask individuals, they're mostly happy with their care. But why is it costing 10 times as much as it does in another country? Most of these medical treatments are exactly the same here as they are in other developed countries. We're just paying a lot more for them.
You note that Obamacare will tax premiums for the most expensive insurance plans to keep luxury health care spending down. But what does luxury health care spending mean?
Well, it means, you know, if you have what they call a Cadillac plan that will cover, you know, yearly stress tests and, you know, any MRI, full body MRI, those plans are going to be penalized by being taxed. So, you know, it means kind of discretionary spending that's not been proved to be medically useful. We do a lot of that in the U.S. now. And, you know, when people try and rein that in, that we all say, oh, you know, you're death squads and, you know, checking my freedom, which we're really worried about in medical care. But the truth is, if this is going to be affordable, we can't have freedom to choose whatever we want if it's not useful and not good medicine.
Well, you mentioned death squads. Actually, death panels
have been the
big threat because end-of-life care is so expensive. Mm-hmm. And there, I remember maybe 20 years ago or so, the governor of Colorado suggested that if the elderly were sensible, they would just simply die quietly and stop costing us so much money.
Well, you know, the elderly.
He was a Democrat, by the way.
No, I mean, people have very different feelings about what they want at the end of life. And the question is, you first of all, you have to balance what you want against what's possible. And second of all, what I hear over and over again from patients in the series is that they didn't want all this stuff that was done to them, but they were on this like conveyor belt where suddenly they were getting biopsies, they were getting tests. They did not want it.
A caller asks, is there any chance that we could go to a single-payer system? And I've been thinking about that as well. On the one hand, this mess would probably lead some people to think that a single-payer system would be a better alternative. On the other hand, the resistance to it, and this is a market-based plan, might make that even more unlikely.
Yeah, people have said in response to this series, why don't you just say we should have a single payer plan? And I think the point of the series is we have to do something and we're doing nothing, whether it's or not we're doing nothing, but the Affordable Care Act only gets us a small way to controlling costs. There are market-based solutions. There are single payer plans. I did find over the course of reporting this that more and more people seem to be in favor of a single payer plan. They're so frustrated with this market system, including a lot of Republicans. I'd love to see a poll about what Americans think about single payer now.
Your next article in the series is going to be about dermatology?
No, it's going to be about more broadly about physician payments and how different practices monetize their services.
Because I was wondering whether you could say that we're being skinned.
Well, skinned, I'm not sure. I think we're not getting value for money as we do in almost every other aspect of our lives. I think that's fair to say. We are not being good consumers. We're not being allowed to be good consumers, and no one is being a good consumer for us. So we've got to do something.
A caller has asked why insurance companies base their fees on billed rather than paid fees to doctors.
Insurance companies have various ways of deciding how they're going to reimburse. But it's like a game. If I'm a hospital and I want to make more money, a number of insurance contracts will say we'll pay 50% of bill. So I just increase the bill. Other insurance companies will say we're going to give you a per diem rate based on Medicare plus pays plus 70% or plus 20%, because most hospitals say they lose money on Medicare, although that's a very difficult calculation. So there are a million different ways to calculate reimbursement, but all of them are kind of drawn out of thin air is the problem.
Isn't Medicare actually designed to pay cost plus a little bit?
That was the original design. Hospitals will generally say it doesn't do that. But
well, if you're charging $137 for a bag that costs you a dollar, obviously.
Right. And there's the question of how you calculate cost. Did you need that new wing? Do all patients really need private rooms? Sure, Medicare's not going to pay enough if that's your standard.
Elizabeth Rosenthal, a series at the New York Times is called Paying Till It Hurts. So is a painful pleasure talking with you.
Sorry. Thanks.